Funding for THINK comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to THINK on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What did the 1980s mean to you? And what role do the values and trends the country embraced back then play in today's world? While leg warmers, permed hair, and Rubik's Cubes thankfully went out of fashion in due time, the legacy of the decade's cultural offerings and political and social climate seems to have more staying power. In fact, journalist David Sirota would argue that prevailing American attitudes about money, power, and national security have their roots in the 1980s, and he explains why in his new book, Back to Our Future, how the 1980s explain the world we live in now, our culture, our politics, our everything. David, welcome to THINK.
Thank you so much for having me.
You argue here that in many ways, 9/11 sort of catapulted the U.S. back to 1986 thinking. Can you talk about what that means?
Well, what I argue in the book is that we are still living in the 1980s, and 9/11 is kind of a good example of the aftermath, really. The reaction to 9/11 is really an example of that. One of the hallmarks of the 1980s was the idea that militarism was the solution to our problems. And this was a big change in the 1980s specifically. Obviously, we were a country that has gone to war well before the 1980s, but at the beginning of the 1980s, we saw polls, Gallup's polls showed that about half of Americans were questioning the fundamental tenets of militarism, of the military as an institution, a lot of people expressing a lack of confidence in our military posture in the world. By the end of the 1980s, the number had gone to 85% of Americans expressing full confidence in the military. The military had become the most respected institution in society, and that's where that number has basically stayed ever since. And the question is what happened in between the beginning of the 1980s and the end of the 1980s. And if you look at the popular culture and the political culture of the 1980s, which was constantly reaffirming this idea that the military is the central organizing institution in our society, that's basically the message that we get today, and certainly that we got after 9/11. And just to be very specific about it, one of the other things that I think came out of the 1980s as it related to the aftermath of 9/11 was not only were we being told that the military is the central organizing institution in society, but that our enemy is going to be, in the 1980s, we were being told it was going to be a stateless terrorism. There was a lot of cultural products that were moving us towards looking at, for instance, Muslims and Arabs as our number one enemy. I mean, you can look at professional wrestling. The big bad guy was the Iron Sheik. You can look at G.I. Joe. You can look at the movie The Delta Force, which, of course, has a lot of memories to the last couple of days as it relates to the Bin Laden mission. So a lot of the way we still think about these issues is framed by what we learned in the 1980s.
Yeah, even a property as innocuous as Back to the Future, which is funny because, of course, it inspires your title. But there is, people may not even remember this now, but there is this scene where they are sort of out of nowhere pursued by, I think it's Libyan terrorists in that movie.
Mm-hmm. That's right. This is one of the first scenes. And I cite this in the book, and, you know, Dr. Brown screams, "It's the Libyans." And what's telling about that, and it goes right to the point that I was making, was that in the 1980s, the shorthand for bad guy became Arabs and Muslims. That a movie, Back to the Future, which isn't about really terrorism, but they needed a bad guy that Marty McFly would flee into the past from. The shorthand, the easiest, quickest shorthand for bad guy was a kafia-clad Arab. And this remains the way we think about our national security threats today. And again, I want to be very clear. I'm not saying that it's all a creation of popular culture. Obviously, there have been conflicts in the Middle East. There was the Lebanese bombing in the 1980s. But my point in the book is that a lot of the real-world events that were happening in the 1980s were cartoonized by popular culture and political culture of the 1980s to bring us to a point where whenever we think about our major national security challenges, the first thing we think of is militarism. The second thing we think of, many of us do, is that Arabs and Muslims are the boogeyman.
So do you think that set us up to be hypersensitive to attacks that did, in fact, affect American citizens?
I think it shaped the way we react. I mean, I think it there were many ways we could have reacted as a nation to, for instance, 9/11. We could have said, maybe the fact that our military posture in the world is occupying countries is something that we should reevaluate. Maybe we should reach out diplomatically to the rest of the Arab and Muslim world to look at how we can build more ties in that world, as we, of course, pursue Osama bin Laden and the specific terrorists that went after us. Instead, the way we reacted as a country, and again, not just our politicians, but we as a society, we reacted by saying, let's intensify that militarist posture. Let's intensify the demonization of all Arabs, of all Muslims, as the problem. And so my point is that I think it shapes the way we have been responding to real-world events.
So also, when you look at Washington, it's sort of impossible to talk about the 80s without really discussing the influence of Ronald Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
We had a president, for the first time, insisting that government was not going to be the solution to our problems, but in fact had all, during the decades previously, been the problem. How did that philosophy affect the way Americans started to view national institutions that before they had sort of assumed to be at least reasonably benevolent?
Well, Ronald Reagan, you're exactly right. I mean, I've been asked this question a lot of times. People have said, well, did Ronald Reagan create the 80s or did the 1980s create Ronald Reagan? And I think there was a symbiotic relationship, which is not surprising because Ronald Reagan kind of straddled the line between politics and popular culture. He was a guy who came out of the popular culture world as an actor. He was constantly making one-liner references to movies and TV shows and the like. Of course, one of the new narratives that he introduced into really mainstream political culture was not just that the government should be limited, but the government is evil. And this was being reiterated in popular culture, specifically culture aimed at children,
mm-hmm.
In cultural products as diverse as the A-Team, to Dukes of Hazzard, to all sorts of cop movies that show that the only way that the government can do anything right is to let cops go rogue. So these cultural products, I think, joined with the rhetoric of Ronald Reagan and Reaganism to say to us, to start selling us on the idea that government is not benevolent, government is not innocuous, government is the problem, as Ronald Reagan said. And I think that the reason that endures so much is not just because the Reagan Revolution was so powerful, but because an entire generation of children were being sold this idea in cultural products that weren't seen as political. Therefore, they were more powerful. Propaganda is in its most powerful form when it comes in a form that the person who's the target of the propaganda doesn't realize it's propaganda. Children, I mean, the A-Team is a good example. There's all sorts of anti-government hysteria in the A-Team, the whole construction of the story. It had the biggest audience among kids ages 3 to 11. Those kids have now grown up, and those kids now, when they hear the government is evil, we have to rely on private contractors, you can't trust the government in anything, those kids are not surprisingly going to be more easily able to accept that message because they've been hearing that message at the very earliest stages of their life when they were first forming the storylines that they've been telling themselves.
Yeah, and those kids, of course, are the generation of adults that is you and me today.
Mm-hmm.
There was also even the story of E.T., where it was the government that killed this delightful delightful alien that wasn't out to hurt anybody.
Right. And what's really interesting about E.T., and I encourage people to go back when you see it on reruns to watch it from this perspective, is that every picture of the government in E.T., I mean, first of all, you have the story of the movie. You're right. The children have to flee the government to save the hero, E.T. That's the whole storyline. Kids shouldn't go to the government for help. They should flee the government. But every image you see of the government is of a pernicious government. You've got the windowless van surveilling the house. You've got you only see government agents for the first three quarters of the movie from their waist down as they traipse over the suburbs. At one point, you have government agents, federal agents, aiming shotguns at children. By the way, this was deliberate. We know this because, get this, in the re-release of E.T., Steven Spielberg looked back on this and said, you know, I think I went a little too far here. And he actually had them digitally edit out the shotguns that the federal agents were wielding, aiming at children. The point in bringing that story up is to say this was not some accident. It wasn't a conspiracy, but the narrative of the government is the problem, the government is evil, among cultural producers, the Spielbergs, the movie houses, the TV studios, they were doing it, again, not as a conspiracy, but as a way to reflect what was becoming the dominant shorthand in the 80s and remains the dominant shorthand today.
Journalist David Sirota is my guest. His new book is called Back to the Future, Back to Our Future, How the 1980s Explained the World We Live in Now, Our Culture, Our Politics, Our Everything. We'd invite you to join the conversation, tell your stories of memories from the 80s and how they might affect us today. You can do that by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also drop an email to think@kera.org. We'll be back to our discussion with David Sirota in just a couple of minutes. Right now, we do want to encourage you to support this station by making a contribution online at kera.org or by calling 1-888-694-6931. We do have copies of David Sirota's book, Back to Our Future, available today with a contribution at or above the $120 level. Hello, Jeff Whittington.
Hello, Chris Boyd. Yeah, you can enjoy the book while you're, you know, watching your DVD of Back to the Future, or maybe the collection of Cosby Show episodes that you've got, or, you know, it's a really great look back and actually really intuitive look at how our cultural aspects of our culture tend to repeat themselves and influence us. It's really fascinating, and we're really excited to have him as our guest today. We hope that you're fascinated. Obviously, you are. You're listening. You're enjoying the conversations on this show every single day. We just ask that you do a part to help pay for part of it by calling 888-694-6931 or by contributing online today at kera.org.
One thing that Jeff and I do when we're planning what we're going to have on the show, we like to sort of have a very good mix of different kinds of topics. And we like works like this that aren't simply, you know, there are plenty of things out there that are like, remember this from the 80s, remember this from the 70s. But this one actually has sort of ideas attached to it that cause you to think. You may agree with everything. You may disagree. The point is not to convince you of anything. It's just to sort of have this interesting conversation and move all of our minds in a direction we may not have taken them before. We are so grateful to have you as an audience come along with us for this and participate in the conversations, to sort of talk to your friends about it. We know some of you blog about the show. It's also really important to us that we have your financial support because your dollars pay for this program to be produced here in the studio.
And we also know that the way you use radio, you know, maybe there is a lunch group that gets together and listens to the show. That would be really interesting to see.
We'd love to hear from you.
but more than likely, you listen to the show, and it's you. It's Chris and it's me. It's the three of us, and we're really talking to you. We're asking you to help support this kind of show. Of course, we know there are thousands of you that listen every single day. Thousands of you are listening right now. But the way you use this service is as an individual, and it's really important that you realize the importance of your contribution. How your role as a supporting listener of the station really does help us get there. Help us get here every day. Help us turn the lights on every day. We're over $315,000 raised. We're more than halfway to the goal of this membership campaign. Your call right now to 888-694-6931. Your online gift at kera.org will help us get just a little bit closer, and we'll wrap this thing up as soon as possible.
I want to say thank you to Shirley Robin in Flower Mound, also to Everett Henson in Dallas. If you are on the line now, we would love to read your name. Of course, you do have a choice. If you don't want us to, you can just indicate that, and we will, mum will be the word. Your contribution right now of $120 or more at kera.org or 1-888-694-6931 will allow you to choose, if you are interested, a copy of Back to Our Future by David Sirota. It's a fascinating book. Of course, you don't have to take a thank you gift, but we encourage you, if you want to read it and support the station, to do both at once. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes to our conversation with David Sirota.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's summer youth programs. Camps in Legos, writing, art, reading, math, and science held at SMU in Plano and on the main campus, Dallas. Learn more at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist David Sirota. His new book is called Back to Our Future, How the 1980s Explain the World We Live in Now, Our Culture, Our Politics, Our Everything. Join us by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I want to talk about money, David. The 80s were a time people remember. Dynasty, they remember it was flaunting your wealth was suddenly not something to be ashamed of, but something that everybody was doing. And if you have a mantra from that decade concerning money, it's from the movie Wall Street. Greed is good. Did everyone fall asleep at the end of the movie where Gordon Gekko sort of got his just desserts?
That's a good question, and there was actually an interesting interview. I think it was with Vanity Fair that Michael Douglas was talking about this, and he said that after, in the years after Wall Street was made, people would come up to him and tell them how much they liked his performance as Gordon Gekko, and he was disturbed at the fact that they saw Gordon Gekko as a hero rather than as a cautionary tale. Wall Street is a movie. If you watch it now, it's clearly Oliver Stone's commentary, or really lament, about the culture of greed is good. Of course, the term greed is good comes from an actual speech made by the multimillion-dollar investor Ivan Boesky, and so Gordon Gekko was based on kind of real iconic figures of the 1980s. But the movie was meant as a lament. But the fact that it has been interpreted as a celebration shows just how powerful that idea had really become, just how, frankly, spot on Oliver Stone really was in that movie. When you look at the polling data out of the 1980s about changing attitudes of Americans and what the American dream became in the 1980s, you see that the American dream went from a middle-class dream to a lifestyles of the rich and famous dream. Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, of course, a very well-known 1980s show. A lot of our cultural products in the 1980s were selling this idea that greed is not just tolerable, not just something that happens to be in society, but that greed is good. I mean, you think about Dynasty, Dallas, you think about kids' shows like Silver Spoon, you think about movies like Brewster's Millions and The Toy. I could go on and on. You get the point, is that the accumulation of great sums of wealth became the American dream. It's not to say that there was no greed before, that people didn't want to become rich before. It's to say that this became a central idea, that the only thing that mattered in society was the individual accruing large sums of wealth. And this was being echoed, of course, in our political discourse as well. And it was Ronald Reagan in a State of the Union address who celebrated multi-million-dollar CEOs as the heroes, quote-unquote, of the 80s. And this, I think, lives on. This lives on, at least in our political rhetoric today. The debate over the Wall Street meltdown, much of the political debate in Washington was not to question greed, not to question the overzealous deregulation that came out of the greed is good ideology, but to nibble at the edges. And I think there's the good news is that while I think our politics is stuck in the 1980s, that our politicians are still really forwarding this greed is good idea from the 80s, I do think there's one silver lining, is that you see in polling data today that more and more rank-and-file Americans are starting to ask, well, wait a minute, maybe that 80s zeitgeist went a little too far, and maybe we should dial things back just a little bit.
At the same time, we have Donald Trump mounting what appears to be a serious campaign for the White House.
Right, and I think he is kind of hearkening back to the 1980s. I think he's, in some ways, his candidacy or faux candidacy is a gamble that he can resurrect that idea from the 1980s. And I do think that we are having, underneath all of the day-to-day political battles, we are having kind of an epic battle between something new and something old. That Donald Trump, I think, and frankly a lot of the Tea Party rhetoric, represents a regurgitation of a pure form of all of the themes that came out of the 1980s. And the question is whether that will win out or whether something new will win out. But Donald Trump, it's exactly right. I mean, this is an icon of the 80s representing an ideology of the 1980s. And it's a big bet that the 1980s is still very much relevant to our society today.
Let's go to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Jillian is on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Jillian.
Hi, I just had a super quick comment. This is fascinating to listen to, but I was a child of the 80s, and I had all of the My Little Ponies. So was my husband, and he had had all the Transformers. And when I was pregnant with my first, that's when they started re-releasing the My Little Ponies. And a few years later, when I was pregnant with my second, they started re-releasing the Transformers. And that's when it kicked in that, you know, they're perpetuating what we did or what we had as children with our children, and there's absolutely nothing has changed. It's just rehashing the same thing over and over again, and that was all. And this is fascinating, and I am a member.
Thanks very much for being a member, and thanks for your call, Jillian. What do you think about that, David?
Well, I think that, and this is how I start the book, I ask the question, why are all of these brands and products being re-released, remade? I mean, you see it in movies, you see it in toys, you see it really everywhere. And I think there's a couple reasons for that. I think one, frankly, I think cultural producers have become lazy, and they want to basically bet on brands that have already succeeded. So there's that. I think they're also betting on the fact that nostalgia can sell. So those are basic business decisions. Whether they're good or bad, you know, who knows? Whether they work out or not, who knows? But I think the third thing that the regurgitation of all these cultural products really says to us is that the producers of cultural content think, and I think they're right, they think that the language of the 1980s is still the language that we speak today. That they're basically making a bet that when they do a movie of the A-Team, or they re-release or do a remake of Karate Kid, that they're basically betting that the very themes in those movies are still the language we're thinking about, that we think in today. They're still the storylines that we tell ourselves today. And that is really, I think, the problem. That's why I wrote this book, is to say that a lot of the storylines that we started telling ourselves in the 1980s come with very, very serious ideology, and that some of that ideology may actually be outdated for the modern world. It's not 1980 anymore.
It's interesting that you brought up Karate Kid, because I have kids now who are school age, and I watched the new version with them, mm-hmm. and it is even more violent than the first one.
Mm-hmm. And I would say that it's an extrapolation of what started in the 1980s. I mean, if you want to talk about how much violence was really became a mainstream product for children, the 1980s is the place to look at that. It seems almost mundane today, but it wasn't in the 1980s. And I'll give you two really good examples. The movie Red Dawn,
yeah.
Which was at the time the Guinness Book of World Record holder for killings per hour, the most violent movie ever made at the time, was also the first movie that got not an R rating, but a PG-13 rating. Hmm. So that is and of course it was a movie that was cast with a lot of teen heartthrobs, a movie clearly aimed at children, a movie that was extremely, extremely violent. The A-Team, now granted there wasn't a lot of killing in the A-Team, but there was certainly a lot of violence. The A-Team, as I mentioned, had one of the highest ratings among preteens, kids age 2 to 11, and was considered by watchdog groups at the time one of the most violent television shows ever to be made. So I'm not surprised that the new Karate Kid is more violent than the old Karate Kid, but I also think it's important to remember that all the violence that is infused now in products for children, that wasn't the norm until the 1980s.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Mark. And Mark writes, I can't help but wonder about the way your guest is presenting the anti-government view as being a recent phenomenon where the 80s are recent. Seems like our founding fathers, including Hamilton, had a much more skeptical view of government than anyone in recent history. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that a lot of the themes that were amplified in the 1980s certainly existed throughout American history. I think that's absolutely true. My point here is that they never became the mainstream, they never got mainstream traction. They never became the dominant paradigm in our politics until the 1980s. That we, as I said, we've always been a country that's been suspicious of too much government power. We've always been a country that has been organized around the idea of limited government. But we haven't necessarily been a country that has seen government as evil. And I want to put an even finer point on it. One of the things that comes out of the 80s is that we sort of get this kind of contradictory view of government. Government, if government means the military, which is one of the biggest parts of our government, the 80s taught us to say the bigger the government, the bigger that form of government, the better. Government that means providing for the general welfare, that part of the Constitution that kind of encapsulates social programs and the like, that's the part where we started saying that's not only, we shouldn't only limit that government, we should see that part of the government as completely evil. I mean, that was seen in everything from Ronald Reagan ripping on welfare queens to all of the movies and cultural products that we're talking about. So that is another part of this question that comes out of the 80s, the sort of unstated differentiation between the kinds of government, the militarism agencies of government that we wanted to be bigger than ever, and the other parts of government that we wanted to crush because we saw them as evil.
My guest this hour is journalist David Sirota. His new book is called Back to Our Future, How the 1980s Explain the World We Live in Now, Our Culture, Our Politics, Our Everything. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We'll come back and talk to some more with David in a few minutes. Right now, we would invite you to call our other number, a really important number for this week and last week and perhaps part of next week, 1-888-694-6931. You can also make a contribution of support at kera.org. We are looking right now to raise the money we need to keep going until our next fundraising drive. These numbers that we come up with, in this case, our goal is $625,000, are not arbitrary. We don't, the folks downstairs don't just say, hey, let's come up with $625,000. They calculate what the expenses are to bring you the kind of quality programming that you expect and rightfully demand from this station. So we ask humbly but insistently for contributions from you to keep this station strong. Jeff Whittington is back in the studio now. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. You know when that next membership campaign is going to be after this one's concluded?
In the fall?
In the fall.
Yeah.
Yes,
it's
indeed.
A long time away. It feels like a long time away.
A long, hot Texas summer between now and the next membership campaign. So if you can see clear to do your part right now to join the station, that'd be great. 888-694-6931 is the phone number. Online, you can make your contribution at kera.org. I think we have treaded into the danger zone, though, of a maybe a far too interesting guest for the membership campaign. And I want to thank, and I know he's listening right now on the phone, but I want to thank David Sirota for rescheduling. We originally scheduled him a couple of weeks ago, and we were preempted by a presidential press conference on the economy, I believe, at the time.
We definitely wanted to have him on.
Absolutely. I mean, we're so thrilled to have him. And obviously, many of you are listening. There are a lot of people holding. There are a lot of emails that are coming in. It's a great topic. But I hope that you'll take just a moment right now when we're not talking, when Chris is not talking to David, and call the number 888-694-6931 or go to kera.org and contribute. And as a reminder, we have David's book, Back to Our Future, available for you today when you join the station at the $120 membership level or above. Of course, the book's out. It's getting a lot of attention, and you can find it practically anywhere, I'm sure, but we would be thrilled to thank you with a copy when you join the station today.
We know how many of you consider yourselves lifelong learners, and we know how often it happens that you are talking to a friend or a neighbor or your spouse or a coworker, and you say, you know, I heard this thing on KERA the other day, and it starts a conversation, or it makes you think the next time you're at the bookstore that you want to get a copy of the book that was discussed. Those are wonderful things, and we know that listening to KERA adds a lot to your life, adds a lot to what you decide to explore further on your own. We would ask, though, that, you know, every time you think about, you know, purchasing a book or going to see a film or listening to an artist or, you know, looking at an exhibition at the museum, consider for all those times that maybe every time that happens to you in the course of a year, that's worth a $10 contribution to KERA. So maybe in the end, it's you know, a $120 gift or a $350 gift. We have lots of ways to say thank you, depending on what you were able to contribute contribute to the station, but we do ask you to consider that there are expenses at this station that are not just our expenses, but really it's your public radio bill because your needs are being served by this station.
And I would like to thank everyone who's contributed so far during the drive. Your contributions have gotten us this far, and we are a little over halfway on the drive toward our overall goal of $625,000. But you, if you haven't contributed yet, if you haven't called or contributed online yet, know that your contribution will get us that much farther toward the successful conclusion of this membership campaign. Really, we just hope that everyone who listens will take a moment and give a little bit to the station in thanks for the content that you get here every single day. You can do it at KERA.org. You can do it on the phone quickly and easily if you call 888-694-6931. But please do it today. Why wait? Why put it off? You've been thinking about joining the station. Why wait any longer?
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can also go online to KERA.org. We do have copies of David Sirota's book, Back to Our Future, available today as a thank you gift at or above the $120 level. We have a lot of other thank you gifts as well. If you've heard us mention something earlier in the week or during a different program, most of those things are still available. So if you thought to yourself, I wanted to make a contribution but was waiting for them to mention the Ken Burns Super PAC again or the Waving Queen, or any of the things that we've discussed, then those things are still available. So please don't let that be an impediment to you calling right now.
888-694-6931, online at KERA.org. The Ken Burns Super PAC is a whole bunch of DVDs. It's all four of his documentary series, The Civil War, Baseball, The National Parks, and The War, which was about World War II. It's a fascinating set of documentary films, 61 hours in all, I believe, is what we've been told. And it's yours when you join the station with a contribution of just $350 or more. That's for a whole year of listening, and you get that great Ken Burns Super PAC. It's a great deal. You can find it online at KERA.org.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. As Jeff mentioned, KERA.org is the website. We always love it when you make your contribution on the web because there's a slightly lower processing cost per contribution. However, we're happy to absorb that if you would prefer to make your contribution on the phone. You can do this with a debit card. You can do it with a credit card. You can send in an old-fashioned paper check if you choose. Or you can set up a sustaining membership. You send a few dollars a month automatically. It just comes right out of your checking account and goes into our membership account. However you want to do it, your participation is really important right now. Love to hear from you at KERA.org or 1-888-694-6931.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Summer Youth Programs. Camps in Legos, writing, art, reading, math, and science held at SMU in Plano and on the main campus, Dallas. Learn more at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Journalist David Sirota is here this hour. His new book is called Back to Our Future, How the 1980s Explained the World We Live in Now, Our Culture, Our Politics, Our Everything. Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Andrew on the line in Dallas. Hello, Andrew.
Hi. Actually, David was just commenting on my question before you went to break, but I'll sort of restate it. I was really curious as to the juxtaposition with the people who are so anti-government yet using these examples like A-Team and E.T. and whatever, and how it's always the military or law enforcement that was the bad guy, yet there's great support for military and law enforcement among that same crowd. And I was wondering if you had any insight as to how they, deal with that idea, but not liking social programs. And I'm also a member, and I love your show, and I'll take the answer off here.
Thanks so much for all of that, Andrew.
I think the answer is about how the 1980s and how we still, again, differentiate between different parts of the government. The 1980s, I think a lot of what you saw in terms of the evil government was a bureaucratic government, the things that we think of as bureaucracy. I'll give you another example. The bad guy in the Ghostbusters, who tries to shut the Ghostbusters down, is a representative of the Environmental Protection Agency, Walter Peck. My point here is that the government is portrayed in a lot of the 1980s as an evil, bureaucracy, but that the parts of the government that aren't portrayed as that are either the military as a whole or rogues within the military and the law enforcement agencies. And this is something I think that is really profound, that comes out of the 1980s, that really, obviously, if you pay attention to presidential politics, for instance, it continues to define the way we think of government. The Reagan years needed to come up with a way to explain the things that the government undeniably does well, or that conservatives in particular undeniably support, like our military posture in the world. So this differentiation was being made, and the way to explain the way the government was doing things undeniably well, even as you're demonizing the government, is to say that what the government does well is a product of individuals within the government breaking the rules inside the government, or, of course, outsiders forcing the government to do things that it isn't doing, or doing things on behalf of the government that the government refuses to do. So if you look at, for instance, again, just off the top of my head, you know, the show Highway to Heaven, right? A rank-and-file 1980s show, you needed an angel outside of the government to solve society's problems that the government refused to solve. All of the cop dramas of the 1980s, a good example of Die Hard, right? The hero in Die Hard is a public employee. It's John McClane. But he is only able to be a hero by breaking the rules and regulations put on him by his superiors.
By going rogue.
By going rogue, exactly. And this is the way our politics are defined today. In almost every congressional race to the presidential race, it's always about which candidate is going to get inside the government and then go rogue and break all the rules on behalf of the good. And the problem with this, I think, is that what this has done is it has created a way we look at our politics that says institutions don't matter. The common good matters, but the only way that we can get to the common good is to not rely on institutions, but to rely on individuals. It's the opposite of the John Adams quote, and John Adams' famous quote, "We're a nation of laws, not a nation of men." What the 80s was saying is actually, no, we should be a nation of men who go rogue whenever they see fit to protect the common good and forget about institutions because institutions are evil.
You also had in the 1980s this awakening of the idea that it was wrong to have poorly treated Vietnam veterans as they came back. And you had movies like Platoon and Born on the 4th of July, although that may have been very early 90s. I can't quite remember. But there was that sense that, you know, in sort of glorifying individual soldiers, suddenly the military, and looking at them with more empathy, the military became a more decent, you know, it wasn't about supporting the top brass. It was about supporting the men and women who were fighting. And it was a sort of a shift in attitude.
Yeah, and this was very, very deliberate. A lot of the early 1980s and then into the mid-1980s, a lot of the movies that were about the military were about refighting the Vietnam War or explaining the Vietnam War, explaining what happened in the Vietnam War. And one of the key explanations that rose up, again, from Ronald Reagan and in our cultural products was this idea that the politicians didn't let the mistreated troops win. That was a big idea, this idea that the troops were spit on when they came home. Anti-war protests during Vietnam weakened the country, hurt the rank-and-file troops. It took the focus away from the idea, for instance, that maybe the military brass and the military leadership had the wrong policy, had too hubristic a policy, didn't treat the soldiers well in the sense of sending them into a war that they couldn't win. So what comes out of this is this notion that we can't question war because to question war is to question the troops. Of course, the whole idea that troops got spit on when they came home from Vietnam is completely apocryphal. There's a whole book written about that separate question, called The Spitting Image, where there is actually no documentary evidence at all to suggest that troops that came home got spit on by anti-war protesters. Zero. It's completely apocryphal. Yet it was totally embedded in a lot of the military popular culture of the 1980s. I mean, this idea of the only thing that we can do right for the military is to let the troops win, suggest that in Vietnam we unduly confined the soldiers. We didn't let them use things like napalm and burning the village down to save it. And that's not to indict the military. It's only to say that the idea that we lost the Vietnam War because we didn't let the troops use as much force as they wanted to is ridiculous, but it remains the way we think about military and military operations today. I mean, President Bush was constantly making reference to the fact that even as commander-in-chief, he wasn't going to make decisions about war because he was going to leave it to his commanders on the ground. This is the let-them-win idea. By the way, that line, we have to let the troops win, was a line both said by Ronald Reagan repeatedly and was the, I believe it was the first or second line of the Rambo movie, Rambo 2. So it's just an example of how this was echoed both in politics and pop culture.
All right, let's shift gears here a little bit and talk about what you call the Huxtable effect. The Cosby Show, of course, in the 1980s was hugely popular. Americans in general embraced it. A lot of white Americans watched the show and really loved it. And there was this sense that, at least by white America, okay, this means that we can move beyond race now in this country.
Yeah, and there was a lot of audience studies done about what people were getting from the Cosby Show, and what the Huxtable effect came to mean was that the show basically made an implicit deal with white America. It said we're not going to challenge you on the questions of lingering institutional racism, and we're going to humanize a middle class, or really an upper middle class African American family, in a way that doesn't minstrelize that family. And so the bargain was to show on TV for the first time a well-to-do African American family that mass white America agreed to accept in exchange for not being challenged on questions of persistent racism. There was a whole debate about this in the 1980s. Was this denying the problem? Was the Cosby Show helping deny the problem that racism still existed, or was it showing a humanized picture of African Americans to white America? Was that good or was that bad? My point in the book is to point out that this is what happened. That during the Cosby era, the number of working-class African-American characters in TV all but disappeared, that the Cosby Show, as one example, didn't really address institutional racism, that white audiences actually said in audience studies that the reason they liked the show so much was precisely because of that. And it created this idea, or forwarded this idea, that we live in a colorblind, quote-unquote, post-racial society, which, of course, is what we've been told in the lead-up to and aftermath of the presidential election of 2008, and that the only African-Americans that white America is willing to accept on a mass basis at the Cosby Show level or the Oprah Winfrey level or the Barack Obama level are African-Americans who, quote-unquote, transcend their race. Now, there is an inherent bigotry in that whole idea. White America asking African Americans to go beyond who they are, go beyond their ethnicity. The assumption is that their ethnicity or their race is a bad thing. And this defines the whole way we talk about race today. Anytime President Obama even talks or even vaguely refers to the issue of race, he's accused of being the opposite of post-racial, as if that would be the most horrible thing in the world.
So how long do you think 80s redux will last in this country?
Well, I think that's the open-ended question. I mean, I think there's evidence to suggest that we continue to rehash the 80s on loop. I think there's some evidence to suggest that maybe we're moving beyond it. I mean, I think that when you look at polls, for instance, about people saying that they think we spend too much on the military, that's a suggestion that maybe our country is starting to realize, for various reasons, that militarism, 80s-style huge militarism, isn't the right way to go. I think that we look at polls of the mass public on questions of the economy, and I think there has been a realization that maybe the 80s idea of greed is good is outdated. But I think the problem is that our politics aren't necessarily representing that mass societal cultural shift away from the 80s. I think our politics right now are doubling down on the 80s. I think you see that in budget proposals from the Republicans right now. You see it you see it in a political system that can't even question the generals, can't question military policy. The only thing we should do is just let the troops win. And so the real question is, how much are we as a people, as a mass public, going to drive our politics in a different direction, or how much is our politics going to keep us in the same place? And that's the open question.
The new book by David Sirota is called Back to Our Future, How the 1980s Explain the World We Live in Now, Our Culture, Our Politics, Our Everything. David, it's been a great conversation. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Appreciate all of you who are listening now, who have been calling in to participate in the show. Sorry that we couldn't get to everybody who called and emailed. It's been a busy day. We do appreciate, though, that you are on the line, not only to participate in the show, but also to participate as a member of the team that makes KERA possible, which is exactly what you can do when you become a contributing member of the station. You go online to KERA.org or you call 1-888-694-6931 and simply decide how much you want to spend supporting the station that brings so much to your life every single day. Your contributions really do make a difference to the station. And if you make a contribution this afternoon at or above the $120 level, you might choose to receive a copy of David Sirota's new book, Back to Our Future. Jeff Whittington is back in the studio now. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, Chris. Thanks so much for being with us today during the show. Of course, there's another hour coming up. If you listen to the podcast, you should also know that the podcast has an expense to produce. It takes time, it takes equipment, it takes energy to make that podcast every day. So if you're enjoying that, please consider clicking over to the support page at KERA.org and supporting it. But as I said, there's another hour coming up, so there's more think on the way. But take a moment right now to go online to KERA.org, click on the support page, and fill in the pledge form yourself. Make a contribution, and you can get your own copy of Back to Our Future by David Sirota at the $120 membership level or above today. It's very easy to do, or you can give whatever you want. But we hope that you'll choose to support the station. You've already chosen to listen. You're listening right now, after all. We just hope that you'll make that choice to become more than just a listener.
If there's anything bad about public radio is that it's habit forming. Once you sort of make that shift, maybe as I did, maybe you spent years listening to commercial radio. There's nothing wrong with it whatsoever. But once you sort of discover public radio and what it has to offer and the rhythms of it and the depth of the information and the kinds of conversations that exist and the sorts of questions that are raised and not necessarily answered, it's really hard to be satisfied with anything else. And we know that many of you listen to this station for hours upon hours, not just every week, but every single day. We are so happy that you're with us and that you recognize the value of this. I would ask those of you who've never sort of challenged yourself with this question to do so, which is, why wouldn't you spend a little bit of money to ensure that public radio can stay strong here in your community for you and for the rest of North Texas?
If you've been listening to the station for weeks, months, or maybe even years, you've considered supporting the station. You've thought about it. Maybe today's the day. Why not make today the day? And pick up that phone and call us at 888-694-6931. Why not make today the day that you go over to KERA.org and go on ahead and click on the support banner and support the station with a contribution? Your contribution minus the value of any thank you gift you get is tax deductible. So if you're thinking about being able to write that off next year, you could certainly do that. We are a not-for-profit organization here in the state of Texas, and we are, this is how we raise the necessary dollars to pay the bills that have to be paid to broadcast the show, to call the guest, to have headphones and microphones, to turn the lights on in the studio and be able to send the signal that we put together out to the tower. And then broadcast it to your radio. That's what, or if you listen on the computer, the same deal. We have to set that stream in motion somehow. And it costs money to do that. It actually costs quite a bit of money to do that. And this drive, what we need to raise is $625,000. So we're getting there, but we need to hear from you, and we need your participation to make it.
You can go online to KERA.org or call 1-888-694-6931. This is your source for NPR News, 90.1 KERA Dallas Fort Worth Denton, 100.1 K261 CW Tyler, 88.3 K202 DR Wichita Falls, 99.3 K257 EV Sherman.
I want to thank Kaneda Massey in Dallas and Amy Mumpower and Anita Evans in Plano for their contributions during the show today. Thank you so much for supporting KERA. We really do appreciate it. You know, the things sound different on KERA when you know that you're helping to pay for it. When you make that call to 888-694-6931 or that online gift at KERA.org, it really does make a difference, and it makes a difference in how you listen to the station.
I think about this a lot. You know, most of us sort of keep our private, our checkbooks private and our bank statements, but think about what your bank statement says about you, what you, where you spend your money, what you support, and wouldn't it be nice to have in there just for your own private records among all the grocery store trips and clothing purchases and shoes and everything else you might spend your money on, a contribution to public radio sort of reflects what you value and what's important in your life. We would love to hear from you now at 888-694-6931 or online at kera.org.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.